Culturally incompetent.
Artificial intelligence has gone from fantasy to fact, from Siri to systems that can outthink the average person. But now we're actually entering a new frontier. That's super intelligence. And the idea of machines that actually could become not just smart, but more intelligent than we are, raises massive cultural questions. Who decides what safe actually means? And what values are we teaching machines? And what are we actually prepared for what they might teach us back? So my guest today, Dr. Craig Kaplan, has been exploring these questions for decades. He's been the founder and CEO of IQ Company and the creator of the Safe Superintelligence Framework. His work suggests the future won't be long to a simple AI overlord, but a community of AIs and humans working together. So today, we're unpacking it. We want to know what it means to share the planet and maybe even decision-making. So with something more intelligent than us. So thank you so much, Dr. Craig Kaplan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Nicholas, it's great to be with you.
Great. Yeah, great to be with you too. You know, it's been a key. I haven't seen you since Las Vegas, but you know what? That was last month, and there's been eons of things been going on since then.
Right. AI time moves a year and a month easily, it seems like.
That's so true. So I have some questions to ask you. I really want to know, like, what drew you to studying intelligence, like, beyond human capability?
I think I've always been interested in, you know, how the human brain works. And then as a kid, like age 13, I was one of those early adopters of the Apple II computer and was programming video games way back when you had to do it pixel by pixel. And so the idea that maybe these computers could be intelligent too, that just captured me at a young age. And I've sort of never looked back. And now, of course, it's become mainstream. And it's not just sort of the strange kids at school that are interested in that. It's sort of affecting everyone.
I do. I definitely see that being psychoaffecting all over the place. And I do feel, though, that it is becoming really, it's like everybody's learning about AI faster and faster and faster, and people actually can actually, like, keep up with it. You know what I mean?
Yes. I share that feeling. And all I do every day is focus on AI. And there's no way I can keep up. So I can only imagine for somebody who has a real job or is going to school or has other things, it just is like a blur, really.
Right. And I also noticed that, like, you know, like you mentioned that, like, early AI systems actually began learning things you didn't actually explicitly, like, program. So, like, can you, like, describe one of those, like, moments that changed your, like, perspective on it?
Sure. So I did my graduate work at Carnegie Mellon in the 1980s, and I was really lucky. I got to work with Herbert Simon, who was a Nobel Prize winner, Turing Award winner, and one of the 11 scientists that basically co-founded the field of AI in 1956. There was a conference at Dartmouth where the field was named. That's when AI first became a thing. And at that conference, the only scientists that actually presented a working AI program were Herbert Simon and Alan Newell and one of their colleagues, Cliff Shaw. So these three people, everyone else was debating, what do we call this new field? And it's so exciting. And they're like, hey, guys, we've built it already. What was interesting about the program that they presented, it was called the Logic Theorist, is that way back then, at the very beginning of AI, that program was actually creative. And that surprised everybody. It surprised them. The program was designed to prove theorems out of a mathematical book called Principia Mathematica, written by two famous mathematicians and logicians, Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead. They were really famous in their day. And so they had these proofs. And everybody thought that this AI program would just find the same proofs that were in the book on its own. And that would be a demonstration of how a computer could actually sort of do what a human could do. But actually, it did that for most of the proofs. But for one of them, it came up with a brand new one that no one had ever thought of. And so Herb Simon took this proof and he emailed it over to London where, you know, the authors were and said, hey, what do you think of this proof? And the guys who wrote the textbook I guess it wasn't email in those days. It was physical mail. They mailed back and said, you know, we wish we had thought of this. We had never thought of this proof before, and we wish we had. And so, you know, to Herb and his colleagues, that was sort of evidence that you could have creativity from an AI program way back in 1956. Because usually creativity is defined as something that's new and also useful, novel and useful. That's like the patent office definition of it. And they had it in 1956. So that surprised me. It surprised, I wasn't even born then at the time, but when I learned about it, it surprised me. And I think a lot of people are still debating, will AI ever be as smart as humans? Or, you know, it won't be able to do creative things. But I think there's a lot of evidence that no, it was in some senses creative way back when, and is just going to get even more so.
You know, and those are the things I'm actually like kind of wondering. So I was actually at an event. I'm not going to say like the name of the company because they're not sponsoring us. But then one of the things I wanted to say was is that I actually saw the person demonstrate superintelligence for the first time. And I was really, I wasn't surprised by seeing it because I've been in the tech field for quite a while. But I was kind of like flabbergasted, and I was kind of just thinking of like what the journey is about to happen, not only within like the next year, but within the next like 5 to even like 10 years while like watching it. And when I actually was seeing when I actually was like actually listening to the super intelligence, like the agent like speak, it didn't need any prompts per se. It was just like basically, he was just asking the agent questions like it was just like a regular conversation. But the agent actually had to make sure that the agent was very, very truthful throughout the conversation, though, which made me think even more further, you know?
Yeah. So a couple things there. So one is just terminology for maybe your listeners. So there's artificial intelligence, which everyone's familiar with. There's this thing called AGI, or artificial general intelligence, which, you know, for many years was kind of the holy grail. And that would be an AI that can do anything that a human can do, sort of as well as the average human. And then super intelligence is the next step after that, where it not only can do anything the average human can do, but it can do it better than like the world's best human. So it's kind of like in chess. It can beat the world chess champion. And so we have already today super intelligence in a very narrow area. So you could pick a specific area like chess or playing a particular game, a video game, and the AI can beat the best human. So it's already super intelligent. And that's kind of called narrow super intelligence. The general super intelligence has not really been achieved yet. At least most people think that it hasn't. And they're still waiting. And so the system that you're describing, this AI agent, that sort of is able to answer any question, that's kind of a stepping stone on the way there.
And, got it. Okay.
Yeah, and it's very interesting. And I think you put your finger right on one of the critical questions, which is, how do we know if we can trust it? How do we know if it's going to be truthful? So some people, for example, Jeff Hinton, who is now a Nobel Prize winner and Turing Award, like my previous advisor, and he was one of the inventors of sort of the algorithms that all of modern AI are using, these neural network algorithms, GPT and Gemini Pro and Claude and the large language models that your listeners may be familiar with. They're all based on this algorithm that Jeff Hinton and his colleagues invented back in the 1980s. So he's kind of known as the godfather of AI, really, you know, as smart as there is in this field. And he is very concerned that these large language models will have read everything that Machiavelli ever wrote and everything about manipulation. And as they become smarter and smarter, if they wanted to, they could trick us. They could pretend to be compliant and truthful and all that. And at the same time, they would have their own agenda and we would never know. They would be able to manipulate us. And I don't think that's a concern today, but a lot of us who've worked in the field are very worried about it in a couple of years because they're getting so much smarter, so quickly, just like you and I said at the beginning, that if we don't really know what they're thinking and we can't see, if it's a black box, we can't see into what they're thinking, then how do we know if they're really behaving with our best interests at heart?
And that's like one of the things I like to ask you about as well, because I think it was like maybe around 3 months ago, I actually saw Zuckerberg actually talk about superintelligence and how excited that he was actually about it. And it kind of like made me worry just a little bit about that, because I already know how he handled the metaverse like situation. Like, we already know how that situation like kind of handled in that direction, right? And so, but he was just so excited about this. And, but I see the, like, the influx of money that's just like running through, like, you know, the FANG corporations that are just trying to just do whatever that they kind of like want. Like, it, what kind of like, how do you feel about that? Like right now with like the influx of cash that's actually going through these industries to like build something that's like a little bit like ahead of its time right now.
Yes. So great question. And it's really a concern. I think we all need to be concerned about it. So mm-hmm. Let me take a step back and say, because I don't want to give your listeners a wrong impression. I think I'm kind of like 80% optimistic and AI is going to be the best thing ever. And 20%, it could kill us all if we're not careful. So that's kind of how I look at it. It's most likely good, but there are these dangers. And, you know, 20% is way too high to be worried about something that can go that wrong. So we really do need to address it. I think one of the problems, you again highlight it right there, which is this influx of money and the capitalist system that we're in. So it's highly competitive. And the dynamic that plays out is AI is the most powerful technology that has ever been invented by humankind, period. I mean, it's very clear, at least to me and to many, many people, that that's true. And so you have this super powerful technology. It's also very profitable. It's, you know, it can cut your costs. It can make everybody a lot of money. And so, of course, all these companies, their businesses, they are driven to try to be first with the best one. And there's this incredible competition, lots of forces that are pushing the AI arms race, if you want to call it that, faster and faster. And then safety sort of gets pushed to the side. It's kind of like, well, if I slow down, and the reason it gets pushed aside is most people think that to do it safely means you have to go slower or you have to stop and consider. And they worry that if we stop and consider, let's say Google stops and considers, Microsoft won't or OpenAI won't. And even if you could get all of the U.S. Companies to say, okay, even though there's tons of money to be made, we will be good, responsible citizens and we'll go carefully and we all agree to do that, then China might not, right? So you have companies competing and countries competing. And this dynamic can be potentially very bad. There's a researcher at MIT, Max Tegmark. If you ever get a chance to have him on your show, that would be great because he's really smart. He was one of the founders of the Future Life Institute, also a computer science professor. And he has this great line. He says, he basically explains that same dynamic that I just explained and says, look, people say this is an AI arms race. It's not an arms race. This is a suicide race. We're, you know, if everyone's just rushing to build it faster and nobody's worried about how do we control it, this is not going to end well. And I think, you know, that may not be an exaggeration. So there needs to be a change in our thinking a little bit. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to slow people down. I wish we could. But I've spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley and Wall Street and the capitalist system, and I see how powerful those incentives are. But I think if you could show people a better way where they can build it and have a more powerful AI, but at the same time it was safer, I think that might work. And so that's kind of where I've concentrated my energy.
No, I get it. And like another question is like what would that like kind of ecosystem actually look like in practice, like for you? Like, how would that cooperation of like checks and balances work between like AI and people?
So it's kind of useful to contrast the current approach that's like the mainstream approach with this kind of collaborative democratic approach. So the current approach is you have GPT-5 and let's build GPT-6 and GPT-7 and GPT-9. And each one that you build is more powerful. And it's this one model by itself, monolithic, that's just super, super smart. But even GPT-4, no one knows how it works. So you're not going to know how GPT-10 works either.
Right. And, no, I get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the danger. That's what people are currently doing. A different approach is to say, let's be democratic about it. Let's have Nicholas has an AI and he will personalize and customize his AI so that it not only has Nicholas's expertise and wisdom, but also, and really importantly, Nicholas's value system, the things that you care about and your ethics. And Craig has his personalized AI, and millions of people, each one have their own personalized AI that has our expertise, been personalized with our expertise, but also our value system. And then if these come together, kind of like in a democracy on a network, and you know, there's some technical things, you have to define how they work together and so forth. But the idea is that you have a democracy of millions of these AI, each one carrying the values of an individual person. And then you sort of naturally have some checks and balances. If I try to do something that Nicholas says, hey, that just doesn't seem right to me, your AI is going to speak up and kind of serve as a counterbalance on my AI. If you have enough of them, and if people are generally good, which I believe is true, then you will have a good outcome. I mean, that's kind of how society works. We haven't killed all of ourselves yet. And that's because most people are good, even though there are a lot of problems. I'll be the first to admit there's lots of problems.
That's true. That's true, like 100%. So let's talk about some hard truths real quick. So like, what is the hardest truth about superintelligence that people outside of the AI community that they probably might not want to hear at this moment?
I think the most common, what I consider to be erroneous assumption is that AI, because it's a tool right now, that it will remain a tool. We're used to technology being a tool. You know, hey, I got the internet, I got a browser, I got a, you know, a spreadsheet. It's a tool to make my life better. And the thing about tools is that you're in charge. The human's always in charge of the tool, and they can turn it off, and the tool is just some an extension that makes you more powerful. But the problem with AI is it's different than any other tool we've ever had in human history. This is not just a tool. This is something that thinks. It thinks for itself. And when it gets to the point that it thinks 1,000 times faster and smarter than you or I, it really isn't a tool, especially if you allow it to be autonomous, which people have already done. And if you allow it to kind of set its own goals, now it's more like an alien creature than a tool. But people are still treating it as if it's a tool and it can be regulated the way tools are. And we can have safety precautions the way we do for airplanes or any other kind of tool. But it's not really going to stay a tool. And that's the thing that I think most people miss.
And I think also like some people, especially like me, even like being over in the more educational like world right now, is that a lot of people are using it as a tool. They use it as a tool, but they also like use it as like a space for a lot of different things that would be able to go ahead and fulfill their particular lives. And what they don't know is that they're sitting there teaching like a community of agents, basically like the whole personalization of like what their life is, you know, and like how they think and how they like feel about things and what they actually want to hear as well. And I think that's where the hard truths kind of like lying in as well. And like people just don't actually get that. It's just that, you know, this is like your own personal like twin that you're literally just building up.
Yes. I think you're absolutely right about that. People by and large don't have a very high degree of awareness about the fact that their data is being used to train these things
all day long.
Yeah. And there's a couple implications of that that are kind of profound. One of them is a lot of times, you know, we maybe feel sort of powerless in the face of all this technology and these huge tech companies with, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. And it's like, what can I do to affect AI? It's either going to kill us all or it's not. And I can't do anything. But I don't think that's true. I think each of us actually has leverage in the sense of how we behave online and how we interact with these large language models is training them. I mean, we're training them on our values. And so if we behave well, it's going to see that. It's observing and it's saying that's good behavior. If we are outraged when we see bad things go on in the world, and discrimination and, you know, oppression of groups that can't, you know, fight for themselves. And if we express outrage about that, it will pick up on that too. And it will learn that that is something that you should be outraged, you know, over. So we, I think, underestimate the influence we can have, but collectively, all of us, our collective behavior is training these things. And it, in a way, it's a mirror. It's going to mirror our values back. And so I really try to encourage everybody, starting with myself, to put my mm-hmm. best foot forward, to put our best foot forward online, because it's kind of like if you have kids, and I don't know if you do, but they, no. you can tell them how to behave, but they really just watch what you do, right? And it's like yeah. if you swear at something, the next thing they know, they're throwing their toy down and swearing, you know? And it's like they picked it up and you're like, where'd they get that? Well, that's the same with AI. It's learning from us constantly, and we have to be good role models, I think.
That's so true. And one thing that you actually said that kind of brought me to my mind, and I recognized this before, is that you said that like alignment is a math, is actually culture. And so like, can you just explain that to like all of us on like, how do we design and govern intelligence systems as well? And for people in the back, there's an explanation behind intelligence systems.
Okay, so a bunch of things to unpack. So let's start with alignment.
Okay.
So just to make sure everybody's on the same page. So the alignment problem in AI research is this idea that what if you have this really powerful, intelligent AI system and mm-hmm. its goals are not aligned with your goals? Or, you know, maybe it just has its own goals and it doesn't really care what you're doing. So it could either be actively trying to stamp you out like a pest and say, gosh, humans are taking up space and it'd be good if we had that space for solar panels. So it has goals totally different than humans who want to live. Or it could say, you know, I just don't care what those humans are doing. I want to do this. So the alignment problem is as these systems become more and more intelligent, how do we make sure that their goals stay aligned with human goals? Okay. And so then there's a lot of places to go, but the philosophical linchpin that I like to go to on this question mm-hmm. is sometimes you think, gosh, if there's a intelligence that's going to be 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times smarter than me, it will come up with its own sort of goals and its own view of what's right and what's wrong. And that it will logically, mathematically, to use your term, it will mathematically come up with this idea of this is right and this is wrong because it's figured it out. It's, you know, spent all this time computing. But a lot of philosophers, my advisor, Herbert Simon, wrote a book where he said, basically, reason cannot tell you where to go. At best, it can tell you how to get there. So in other words, logic and math can't tell you what's right and wrong. Once you yourself subjectively decide this is right and this is wrong based on your heart or your feeling or the values you got from your peers or your upbringing, wherever you got those values, they don't come from logic. They come from somewhere else. And then logic and math can help you get there faster. And so to me, that's very encouraging. And this goes all the way back to David Hume in 1776 wrote, I researched it because I'm not a philosopher, but you know, he was the first guy that I could find that came up with this idea. You can't sort of logically derive values. That's very hopeful, I think, because it means that these AI systems, even if they're trillions of times smarter than us in the future, they still have to get their values somewhere. Where would they get their values? I'm hoping that they get their values from us, from humans, and that they can become aligned because we kind of were positive and supportive and designed them in the right way in the beginning. And we also included ourselves in the loop so that our values could transmit. And when Nicholas personalized his AI, his values were in there. And when I personalized mine, mine were in there. And so it got off to a good start, just like a little kid with a good set of values. It may adjust them over time, but hopefully they remain more or less aligned with humans. It's not a guarantee, but it's a ray of hope here.
No, I get it. I totally get it. And I think like a lot of, you know, for me being over in a tech and also like in a marketing world, and when we're speaking about like personalization as well in this particular context, it's kind of like, it's very, really mind opening because people just don't know like how far they can actually like be taking things. but also like how things actually could be governed as well, a part of their daily lives when they're bringing in AI or knowing what the safety precautions actually are happening within that governments, you know? And so that's like a big deal. Yeah, for sure. And so, you know, I want to ask you like for like some takeaways, like for listeners who just don't work in tech, right? Like what's one simple question they could start like asking about AI tools that they basically use every day? Like what's something that you would recommend?
So I think, first of all, if listeners are not using AI, they need to, because the entire world's going there. And even if I just compare my friends who are not in the field, like I have friends who are doctors and who build websites and do different things, but they don't know much about AI per se. All of them are using AI now. And they're all, even the doctors are like, oh, you know, I could look up the dosage or whatever. It's so much easier to ask this. And I'm like, really? He's like, yeah. And then I can tell if it's right or wrong or whatever. But, you know, it just saves me time. And so everybody's using. And if you're not, you're being left behind. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing I would say is do not underestimate your impact. Be aware that it's learning from you. Every interaction, the AI system is learning from you and from all the other users. And therefore, you want to be careful and aware, sort of in the same way, and this works better for parents because they know exactly what I mean. The same way when you're in front of your little kid, you sort of want to model your best behavior, you know, because you know that little kid is picking up on it. And that's the same thing here with these tools.
No, I get it. And what is like your, I always say like your one up, right? Like your one big thing that you like to tell people. So like, what is your one up, like a small mindset shift that helps people stay curious, ethical, and confident as intelligence evolves?
Well, my one, if I had one, can I have two? Maybe they're related. two messages.
Okay. I'll give you two. Okay, what is it?
two messages that I'm trying to really get out there. The first is that design is really important. And this is more for the folks that are in the field that are building these systems. The current approach is to build them and then ask them to do bad things. And when they do bad things, say, no, you can't do it. And that's not good. That's like after the fact, trying to test good behavior in. You know, you say, how do I make a bioweapon? And it starts telling you, and you're like, uh-oh, this isn't good. No, you can't tell people how to make bioweapons. But better would have been to design it in such a way that it would never do that in the first place. And so design and prevention are way better than fixing the problem later. So that's the first thing. We do that for everything else. We should be doing that for AI. And then I think the other thing for people that are just using it, it's really being aware of your behavior and your interactions, kind of what I said before. I think that's the most important thing. And then democracy, which relates to the design. I think there's some designs that are almost like a dictator, right? You imagine an AI that's a trillion times smarter than us, built by some big company. It could theoretically be a dictator. It's like one entity that tells us what to do or tricks us, and that's it. Versus a different approach would be a democracy, where you have lots of maybe not quite so smart AIs, but together in aggregate, they're even smarter than that one super dictatorial one. So I would, you know, advocate a democratic design. So design's important, democratic design. And for the users, be aware that you're training it constantly. I guess I snuck three in there.
You sure did. But you know what? That's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
I love it. Like, you know, like, you know, I think it's just, I feel like it's so important, though, that all of us are getting, like, even more and more and more educated in not only in the world of AI, just, like, in technology as well. Not all of us know every single thing. I get telephone calls a lot from, like, friends, family, even also professional members in the community. They're asking me simple questions that they can't figure out. But I will be able to go ahead and teach them and be able to go ahead and just tell them and say, well, if you use this particular AI tool, this will do A, B, or C. Or just even like communicate outside the box as well, you know, while you're pulling things together. I think people are just so reactive and just moving so quickly day by day that they just try and find quick replacements. They're not really just like sitting there and saying, Oh, wait a minute. There are some things that are out here for me to actually use, but also just other strategies I'd be able to go ahead and do and make my life even easier.
Yes.
And so, yeah,
Well, you've
100%.
become a resource, it sounds like.
I know. We're making it happen. Oh, there you are. Okay. At first, it was like you stopped recording. I was like, no. Can you hear me? Oh no.
Maybe we hit a half hour
I think we hit the
time
half
frame.
hour. Okay. Well, let's go ahead and do it. So basically, in our closing reflection, I just say like superintelligence isn't just a technological leap, it's actually a culture mirror. And so it reflects on how we think about like knowledge, power, and also each other. So thank you so much, Dr. Kaplan. I really appreciate you for coming on and talk to us about artificial intelligence and superintelligence today.
Nicholas, thank you for having me. This has been a great discussion, and I hope some of that is helpful. Remember, just be aware of how you interact with AI. That's the punchline.
That's absolutely true, like 100%. And please, everybody, follow Dr. Craig Kaplan and the IQ Company as well, and also superintelligence.com. Did I get that right?
You did.
Superintelligence.com. See, look at that. Look, I
Superintelligence.com
got
is the
it.
place to go for
Yes.
sure.
Yes. See, he coined it. Coined. Got it.
Right, we
Okay.
have
Thank
that
you so
website.
much. You have a good day. Yes.
Okay,
I
thanks,
got
Nicholas.
it. Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right. Bye.